Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about barriers. We mentioned that barriers were a way of having threads wait for each other, which is something that locks didn't really let us do. Like, locks threads would wait for each other, but it's only just enough so they could take turns. That if we wanted to wait for a thread to finish something, locks weren't a very good fit, especially when we wanted to wait for multiple threads to finish something. And we mentioned that there's this very common pattern that comes up in parallel programming that barriers are sort of designed to support. And this is like when we're computing stuff based on a previous time step for the current time step, then we move on to the next time step and compute stuff based on the current time step, and so on. And in between those, you want to make sure everything for time x is done being computed before we move on to time x plus 1, so we don't try to read values that aren't computed yet. And barriers are a great fit for that. They're reusable, so we just set up one barrier, and we do this barrier wait operation in between each step from every thread, and the barrier wait operation waits for all the other threads. We also talked a bit about lock implementation. So we mentioned the simplest case of implementing locks if we have a single core. The only thing we need to worry about is why would something else run while we have a lock? And the main reason for that would be that an exception happened, like a key press caused the OS to decide to run something else, a timer interrupt caused the OS to decide to run something else. And the hardware has a feature to temporarily disable those external exceptions called interrupts, called disabling interrupts. And that doesn't mean that the hardware completely ignores it. It means that it puts it on hold until you re-enable interrupts. And this was enough to implement single core locks, but we learned that that mechanism of implementing single core locks, well, you know, it's fine for stuff in the kernel, but it's not actually very good for user code. One problem is that if we acquire one of those locks and then don't release it for some reason, like due to a bug, then the system's going to hang. In the kernel, we might say, well, I'm the OS, I better not have code like that. But that's not really an acceptable thing to say about programs that people are running on our system. If we want to do I/O, like if we want to wait for a key press, we can't hold a lock while doing it because this type of a lock prevents us from getting key press events. That's part of how it works. So if you want to do other I/O, it's not possible. So these sorts of locks, you know, they're fine for stuff internal to the kernel. In fact, XV6 disables interrupts for its locks, which is very useful since it needs the locks when it's handling things like switching between processes, which would be really inconvenient to have that interrupted by some other code that also wants to switch between processes. But not really what we want for the sort of locks you're going to use in code you write for normal programs. So then we talked about sort of implementing locks for multi-core, which is also going to get us into today's first topic of implementing better locks for, you know, normal user programs. And to deal with this, we need to think about sort of coordinating between cores with shared memory. And we mentioned, oh, we can do something like locking with atomic loads and stores, but it was awkward. And I mentioned, well, there's actually a caveat to that, that when we looked at how we could coordinate with atomic loads and stores, we kind of assumed that if I like load a value, store a value, that the processor or the compiler will load a value and then store a value. And we learned that isn't always true, that the processor and, or compiler will reorder those loads and stores. It won't do it in a way where it will change your answer if you only had one thread, but generally the processor and the compiler are going to try to optimize the execution under the assumption they don't have to worry about other threads unless you explicitly tell them there are other threads around, be careful. So we have this reordering of memory accesses we saw, that lock implementations and barrier implementations need to do something about. So then we looked at, okay, so we can deal with this reordering by giving some special instructions to the processor and making sure a compiler knows what's going on. How can we actually coordinate in a way that's less awkward than atomic loads and stores? And we looked at how different processors coordinated. We learned, oh, well, the way things actually work, a processor has a way of getting access to a value in its cache and knowing that no other processor has it in use. And this means that processors can implement what we call atomic read, modify, write instructions. So they can have an instruction that reads and writes a value all at once, and they can ensure that that instruction executes without any other processor accessing that value in the middle. That's why it's atomic, so there's no in-between point where we can interrupt that instruction and like see the value being halfway changed, or like read before the write happens and write afterwards. Like, that's not going to be possible on a computing processor because we have this sort of exclusive access for the duration of that instruction. And using that, we implemented a simple type of lock that works on multiple cores called spin locks. So spin locks are so called because they spin. That is, they go in this loop when we're trying to acquire the lock and someone else has it. The operation of acquiring lock is we use an atomic read and write instruction to write the lock is taken and read what it was before. And if we find out that it was before it was not taken, then we know we are the only thread which flipped it from not taken to taken. If we find out before it was taken, then we know, okay, well, it is taken, but some other thread did it first, so I'm not the one with the lock. When we want to release the lock, we just set it to not taken. But for acquiring the lock, if we don't get it on one trial, we just try again and again and again until we get it. And that's spinning operation. And sort of as we alluded to in sort of the last quiz question, well, spin locks are actually enough to coordinate multiple user space threads. They work. But they have some efficiency issues. That because the spin lock just keeps trying and trying, and it doesn't tell the scheduler what's going on, if we're trying to acquire a spin lock and there's some other thing that holds the lock, that other thing is going to get the run when it would get to run. It's not going to get some extra priority. In fact, it might run later because we're busy running this loop that the scheduler might be confused into thinking is important. Also figured out, one thing alluded to by that question is that if we think of, we have multiple threads waiting on a spin lock, who gets to go first? Well, we need something more sophisticated if we want to make a good choice there. Because the way it works with spin locks is that it's whichever processor manages to execute that read and write instruction fastest after the lock is released. So we're not going to go into much more detail about how to implement sort of spin type locks. There's a whole like topic about that, but we're going to talk next about how we can implement locks that are integrated with our scheduler on top of spin locks. So there's a reason we talked about the spin locks, which seem like locks you'd only want to use for something like internals of XV6, and that's because they're in fact going to be our building blocks for better locks, and also for pretty much all the sort of synchronization tools like barriers that we might want to create that might be more interesting than locks. So before I move on to that, questions about any of the stuff we covered last time or the quiz? Yes?
If you have two barriers and you figure one leap, does both barriers use up one?
So the question is, two barriers and a trigger one. Is this about the quiz question with the... In general, so each barrier waits for every other thread to call barrier wait. So if I have one thread calling barrier wait three times, and one thread calling barrier wait two times, well, that thread that calls barrier wait the third time, it's going to be saying, assuming the barrier is initialized with two threads, it's going to say on that third call, it's going to say, where's the other thread? and it's never going to find it, so it's just going to wait forever. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. Yes, so quiz question three. Yeah, so quiz question three.
So, how is it that a A is corrected when B is incorrect? Because with B, you're
locking. So the question is, what's the problem with B? So the problem with B, so on the quiz here, we have this table and we have this item. And with B, it seems like, oh, we're using locks to make sure no one's reading and writing at the same time. And yes. But we're not maintaining the lock over our entire operation. So what can happen is one thread can read the table and find out, oh, there's nothing there. Then the second thread, well, it can run right after the first thread unlocks. And in option B, we have, we're going to hold the lock on the table only for this amount of time. So that means that if we have two threads calling set at the same time, a possible ordering, not the only one, is that one thread does this, then the other thread does this. So in that case, both of the threads could find out, oh, the item is null right now. And then both of them, based on that, would decide to enter that if statement and add an item to the table. And one of the threads would do that first, and the other thread would do that second. The thread that does it second would overwrite the thread that did it first. And as a result, we would so there's a bunch of things which could go wrong, but the most obvious problem to me is that the pointer that the first thread allocated, we won't have anymore. So we won't be able to free it later. Is that answer your question? And I guess I would say the overall intuition you should have is that if you're doing an operation that's sort of one combined thing and you're releasing a lock in the middle, you should be very concerned. You should think, wait a moment, am I assuming something is going to be true after I release this lock and before I acquire another lock again? And those assumptions will get you in trouble. And the assumption we had here, kind of implicitly, was that after I release the lock, there still wouldn't be an item in the table there. Is that? Yeah. So for A, if you interpret it the way I intended, which is that this entire thing here is what's in blank 5, I gave credit for, because apparently a lot of people don't read it that way, which was a surprise to me. A lot of people, including a TA I ran it past, so my fault. I need to use quotes next time. Then what happens is we hold the table lock from here down to here. So that means that only one thread at a time can decide, do I need to add an item to the table or not? And we don't do that in a way where we get confused about whether there's really an item in the table or not. Once we've figured out what item's actually in the table, then we lock that item and unlock the table.
So for A, there's a table lock in line 1 and then
a lock. And then we lock the item and unlock the table in line 5. And so the notion is, now that we know exactly what the item is, we're going to manipulate that item, assuming it won't go away, which if we only have calls to set, it won't. It's going to stay the same, right? Because set can only set the item to a value. If it was null originally, there's no other way to change what the item is. So if we had like a remove operation, maybe we need to be more concerned, but we don't. Other questions? No, right, here. Okay, are there no non-quiz questions are welcome to you, okay. So we're all okay. So mentioned spin locks have a bunch of problems. So one of the problems that we started talking about with barriers, and that we're going to have to be our second topic for today, is that locks like don't do some things we want to do. So barriers sort of gave an example of something where locks were really not a good fit. We're going to have some other examples when we look at monitors later today, which are a much more general mechanism for synchronizing threads. But the other thing we saw is that barriers use a lot of extra compute time because spin locks use a lot of extra compute time because when we're waiting on a spin lock, we're in fact just using as much CPU as the scheduler will let us use. They're going to use a lot of CPU time. And worse, if you think of what happens when we're waiting on a lock, let's say the thread we're waiting for isn't running. Well, you know, we'd rather give up the CPU and let that thread run, but there's no way that's going to happen unless we get just lucky that the scheduler decides, oh, your time is up. Time to run the thing that is going to have the lock. So we're going to want to look at locks that are integrated with the scheduler. And I also have this third bullet that spin locks are actually an inefficient use of that shared bus. We're not going to talk about fixes for that, but just like you to know that there are other ways of using atomic operations that are more complicated but more efficient. So we're going to talk about implementing what's typically called a mutex. So like the pthread mutex is a lock that doesn't typically use a spin lock as its primary way of waiting. It has something better. And the key thing we want to do is we want to sort of give away the CPU while we're waiting. So our lock operation, when you know we can't just get the lock right away, is going to go to sleep. It's going to set our current thread as waiting, and we're going to add ourselves to a list for the unlock operation to use later. So there's going to be a list of threads that are waiting on the lock. The unlock operation is going to use that list to wake up a waiting thread. So we're going to wake up a sleeping thread, and this is from that list. So questions about this high-level idea? Yeah.
Is that list the same as like process table?
Question, is the list the process table? No, this is going to be a separate list. It's not going to be all the process threads in the system. It's just going to be the ones that are waiting on this lock. Now, one concern you might have about this list is, wait a moment. If we have a list, how do we make sure we don't have problems from two threads trying to add something to the list or remove something from the list at the same time? And our solution to that is we're going to use a spin lock. So we're going to use this simple lock that doesn't have any sort of fancy list to implement this more complicated lock. And the spin lock is going to be there primarily to make sure that we don't try to have two threads modify the list of waiting threads at the same time, because that would mess things up. And it turns out there's going to be like a flag saying if the lock is taken or not. So this is going to give us an implementation, which I'm going to start by sketching sort of our data structure. We're going to have a spin lock. We're going to have two variables. We're going to have a Boolean, which is the lock taken right now or not? And we're going to have a queue of waiting threads. So that queue of waiting threads is just a list of threads. And the lock taken flag says, is the lock currently in use or not? And whenever we change lock taken or wait queue or read them, we're going to acquire this guard spin lock. And that's going to be OK because we're only going to have it for a very brief amount of time. It's only when we need to check if the lock is taken or check the wait list in some way or modify the waiting list in some way. So here's our code. This is a bunch of pseudocode. So I'll start with the lock side. So let's start with the simple case. So the simple case for locking is that we lock the spin lock. And that let makes sure that no other thread is trying to change whether the lock is taken or whether threads are waiting. And then we check if the lock is taken. The simplest case is it's not taken. In that case, we just mark it as taken, and we're done. And the simple case for unlocking is we lock the spin lock because we're not supposed to look at the wait queue without acquiring the spin lock first. We find out it's empty, we just mark the lock is not taken, and we're done. So that's the simple case. But that's not the interesting case. The interesting case is when some thread needs to wait on the lock. So in that case, when that thread tries to lock the lock, rather than seeing the lock is not taken, it's going to be taken. So they'll add themselves to the wait queue and mark themselves as waiting. So if we think of XV6, marking themselves as waiting is basically setting that process's state to something like sleeping. So it's not going to be run anymore. Then we unlock our spin lock because we're done changing the wait queue and run the scheduler. This means we'll context switch away. And that's only going to be temporary because later on the scheduler will switch back to us after we have been made runnable. How is that going to happen? Well, the unlock operation, it's going to check if there's a thread waiting. And if there is, it's going to remove that thread from the wait queue, set it to runnable, and that's it. So notice some things we aren't doing. We don't need to run the scheduler right away because we know the scheduler will get to it eventually. We can, but we don't need to. Also, I don't set lock taken as false. I've decided that the thread that's holding the lock now is the one I just removed from the queue. And when it finishes waiting, it's just going to return from lock mutex. So the lock is still taken. It's now taken by the thread I just made runnable. That's why I keep it as true. And if we were tracking which thread had the lock, I changed that information here. Okay, so questions about this mutex implementation?
You set the state to sleeping. That's when it goes in the lock mutex. That's when in the unlock mutex you would change it back to runnable, and then it would continue in that else statement from the lock mutex at some point in the scheduler.
So the question is, when I set the state to sleeping and then unlock, that's when the unlock mutex function could happen?
Yeah.
Yes. And so is your question about when we go back from run scheduler?
Yeah, I was just confused about how you go between the two different.
So the typical thing is that we'll unlock the mutex, we'll run the scheduler, and then sometime much later, some other thread will run unlock mutex. And that thread will set us as runnable, and then sometime later, the scheduler will decide, I should switch back to this thread now. That's the typical pattern. It could happen like quicker or slower, and we'll look at one special case next. But the typical pattern is that this unlock mutex runs somewhere, and then sometime later the scheduler switches back because that's what it does when you switch to it, once you become runnable. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned that's a typical case, but there's a special case we need to worry about. And that's if we get what it turns out to be unlucky, and the unlock mutex runs in between when we unlock the spin lock and when we run the scheduler. So that's not going to be the common case, but if that happens, we have to be worried about how that's going to work. And The biggest problem here is that what if we unlock the mutex and then we happen to run the scheduler right after that? The scheduler could decide, oh, I should switch to this thread that just finished the unlock spin lock. But when we switch to a thread, how do we switch to a thread? We restore its registers. And that thread's registers, well, they haven't been set yet because we haven't switched to the scheduler yet. So we're going to restore a version of the thread's registers from, you know, sometime way up here when the thread was running something else. And that would be really bad. We'll also have two copies of the thread running at once, also really bad. So we need to avoid that situation somehow. So to make that clearer, sort of the scenario I'm worried about that's uncommon, but we need to make sure it doesn't happen, is let's say we try to lock the spin lock, and it happens to happen at the same time as another core tries to unlock it. So in that case, we set ourselves not runnable, the unlock happens, and just happens to, through very bad luck, happen in between this release of the spin lock and the scheduler being switched to. In this case, you know, the unlock happens, we set A as runnable now, and then we switch to the scheduler, we're out of work, and now the scheduler decides, oh, let's run A, it's runnable, and then switches to it without its registers having been saved yet. So this is something we need to avoid. And there's two common solutions I've seen. So on Linux, the solution is that Linux doesn't track the state of threads quite the same way XV6 does. Linux has a separate flag for is the thread running or not from the flag for is it runnable or not. And the scheduler checks both of them. So if it's just if it's runnable and running, the scheduler won't switch to it because it's still running. And that's how Linux avoids it. In XV6, the reason this is avoided is because XV6 is going to acquire the P table lock here, and is going to try to acquire the P table lock here, which is going to prevent thread B from running in between the two operations. And the reason why we require the ptable lock is the general rule in XV6 is that we always hold that ptable lock whenever we're looking at thread states. So we acquire it before we change our state to sleeping. Either of these solutions work, but we need to be careful about what happens at this exact changeover. So questions about this scenario? So our key idea, sort of more generally, is that our lock operation, we just need a way of setting ourselves as not runnable and making sure that we can go to the scheduler and have that happen in a way where, you know, if we're set as runnable later on, we'll get to run eventually. And the unlock operation needs to set threads as runnable after they've been set as not runnable to hand off the lock. Questions? Okay, so some of you looking very closely at this implementation might say, oh, this is actually really useful, and this tells me that, you know, what something I could do is I could lock the lock once, and then I could try locking it again, have another thread unlock it as a sort of way of doing like a two-thread barrier situation. And that's a nice idea, and it would work with this implementation. I'd like to tell you not to do that for pthread mutexes. Pthread mutexes, there are other ways of implementing these locks. And pthread mutex, the documentation says that you have to unlock from the same thread you locked in. Yes, with the locks I showed you, that's not a requirement, but there are other types of implementations. For example, many implementations, like rather than having a lock taken flag, will have the thread ID that's holding the lock, in which case unlocking from the wrong thread will break things. So don't do that, even though it seems like a nice, clever idea. So with that in mind, we want to look at ways of doing things like waiting for an event. And given that I've told you that, sorry, the lock abstraction doesn't let you do it, though we've seen that the things we use to implement it can do it, I'm going to talk about an abstraction for waiting for events. And that's going to be condition variables. And we're going to combine condition variables with locks to make something we'll call a monitor. So locks, give us mutual exclusion, one thing at a time. And condition variables are going to be a way of waiting for an event. And condition variables is a horrible name because you think it's like a condition. It's not really. A condition variable is, as far as we're concerned, a list of waiting threads. So it has an operation wait to wait on the list. And it has an operation signal and broadcast to notify threads on the list to start running again. And if we combine locks and condition variables with the data structures that the locks are protecting and the condition variables are threads waiting for things about, we get what's called a monitor. And sort of in the original vision of this, we might imagine some very object-oriented implementation of this, where the monitor is like literally like a Java object. In fact, in Java, every object is a monitor because every object, well, we have some related data structures, the fields of the object, and we have a lock and a condition variable. In fact, built into every single object in Java. In pthreads, well, pthreads is built for C and not C++, and it's build your own. So pthreads is going to give you locks, and it's going to give you condition variables, and if you want to make a monitor, you just use them together. So let's sort of look at monitors generally. So we have our, looks very much like an object. We have some fields and some operations that use those fields. So we have a lock. And we're going to have this rule that before we access any of the monitor stuff, we're going to be holding the lock. And when we're done, we're going to release the lock. And the way our locks are implemented, our locks should have a list of threads that are waiting for the lock. So these are threads that are about to do some operation on the lock, on the shared data, which they need the lock for. Our condition variables are going to be additional list of threads waiting for something else to happen, for something about the shared data to be true. And these condition variables, which remember are list of waiting threads, are going to have these three operations. So the most complicated one we'll start with is this wait operation. So the wait operation unlocks the lock we specify, and then adds the current thread to that list of waiting threads. And the thread becomes waiting. So like we saw with the mutex implementation, we're going to go to sleep, we're going to run the scheduler, have it do something else. And later on, we're going to become runnable because someone else is going to use one of the other operations to make us be able to run. And the first thing we're going to do before we actually do anything and return from the wait function is reacquire that lock. So we're going to give up the lock as we start waiting. We're going to reacquire the lock before we continue. So we always hold the lock when we're looking at the shared data. We just give it up while we're waiting. Okay, so questions about the wait operation? So the reacquire, so when we get... So we're going to unlock the lock and get the lock back later on. So the broadcast operation, it's going to take all the threads that are waiting on that particular condition variable, so the entire list of threads, and it's going to make them all runnable. And because of how wait works, well, that probably means it's going to end up adding them all to the list of threads waiting on the lock. Right? Because remember, wait The only way they could be waiting is if they gave up the lock and are about to get it back. Or try to get it back, I should say. There's also a signal operation, which is going to choose one of the waiting threads. In the POSIX API, it's whatever one the implementer found most convenient. And it's going to choose one of them and remove it from the waiting queue. And again, the first thing it's going to do is reacquire the lock, so it's going to get added to the lock queue. So questions about these operations on our condition variables, which remember are just list of waiting threads. Yes? So in this example, in this diagram, this is the thread that the signal chose to let run.
To run or wait on the lock?
To run, and the first thing it's going to do when it runs is wait on the lock. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes. So the question is, I've drawn this queue as sort of an order queue. So shouldn't like the thing we get be the first one? So I agree that would make sense. So in practice, all these queues in the systems we'll be using are not ordered or not ordered in an obvious way. So the arrow between the second and the third? This is faded away because we've removed this thing from the queue of waiting threads. So these are like meant to be, this is just faded away to represent that we've gotten rid of that from that list. Sorry, that's not clear. Good, thank you for asking. Other questions? Yeah?
With broadcast, when you select the lock, you're going to unlock.
So the question is, for broadcast and signal, how do we determine what lock the threads are going to start waiting for? It's based on what they pass to wait. Now, I think it is extremely unlikely you are writing correct code if it's not the same lock for every thread. Because remember, we need to make sure the shared data is only accessed by one thing at a time. Or else we might have confusion about like whether the thing they're waiting for is true, which is, remember, going to be a condition about the shared data. We'll have a concrete example in the next slide. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so we've seen the API. Let's do an actual example with the pthreads API. And here I have two functions. I have a finish function and a wait for finish function. So the wait for finish function is going to return if finish has been called in the past, or if not, it's going to wait until that happens and then return. So the way it works is I have my monitor, I have a lock, I have some shared data. My shared data is this boolean, are we finished yet or not? And I'm going to only modify that or read it with the lock. And I have this condition variable, which is the list of threads waiting to find out if something is finished. So list of threads waiting to find out if something is finished. So I always acquire this lock at the beginning of my operations because I never touch the shared data without the lock. And the wait for finished, the first thing I do, that was not written in the place I should have, is check if we need to wait at all. And we'll talk later about while there's a while loop here, because right now it seems like that shouldn't be necessary. An if statement should be fine. But we'll talk about why we need a loop later. So first I check is, did it already happen? And if it didn't, I'm going to use this Conway operation. So I'm going to simultaneously add myself to the list of waiting threads and release the lock. And it's important that that's one combined operation, because that means that I'm going to be on the list of waiting threads before the lock is released. So there's no point at which the finish can be set to true and I won't notice, because the thing that sets finish to true is always going to broadcast, you know, later. As we'll see. And in the finish code, we have this broadcast. So after finish is set to true, everything that called kind of waiting added themselves to that list of waiting threads, we're going to make runnable again. Each one of them is going to be able to run. It's going to acquire this lock. It's going to double check that finish is true and then unlock. So questions about how this code works? So sort of an example walkthrough of what might happen is, here I have my wait for finish thread. Let's say it goes first. So it gets the lock, and maybe while it's like checking the whether things are finished, the finish thread tries to finish at the same time. In that case, well, they're gonna have to take turns because we have a lock. And wait for finish already has the lock, so the finish thread's gonna be waiting. It's gonna call con wait, because it's going to check the finish flag and say, oh, it's false, so we're going to wait. And as it waits, that's going to put itself on the condition variables list and release the lock, which is going to let the finish thread start. Finish is going to be set to true, and it's going to broadcast. That's going to stop wait for finish from being on the list of the condition variable. But the first thing it wants to do next is wait for the lock. The lock's not available yet, so after the unlock happens, then it's going to be able to run. And it's going to check again, because we had a while loop, is the finish flag is now set to true, find out it is, and unlock. So questions on this timeline? So we have more complicated examples. So this is kind of the most complicated case. Possibly a really common case might be finish happens and then wait for finish happens. If that's the case, then we don't even call cond wait, because we check, is it already finished? Say yes, we're done. Okay. So one thing to go over is, why did I have a loop instead of just if statement? Like, from the examples we've looked at, it looks like an if statement would have been fine and would have saved this extra check here, which, you know, is not a big deal, but it, you know, seems like it's just a little inefficient. And it turns out we need it. Even in this example, we're going to see another reason why we're going to want to have a loop a lot of the time. But even in this example, it's necessary because of something inconvenient about how cond wait works. So I told you, cond wait, it causes the current thread to start waiting and put itself on the list of waiting threads until it gets woken up. And that's not entirely true. So if we look up the POSIX documentation, it has this statement, spurious wakeups may occur. What is a spurious wakeup? That just means wait returns for no reason, as far as you can tell. Just decides, we're going to return, there was no call to signal or broadcast, can just return. Anyway, I'd say, why did the POSIX people do this? Like, why did they make cond wait just sometimes not work? And I think there's two reasons. So one is, as we'll find out, it's really hard in the more general case not to have this while loop. That we're going to look at more complicated examples of using cond wait, and it's going to churn out that because of other threads doing things, that we're going to want this while loop almost all the time, even if there were no spurious wakeups. The other reason is that allowing the implementation of con wait to just return in some corner cases makes it more efficient sometimes. But they can avoid doing as complex locking to do something more efficient if they're allowed to say, oh, well, so there's something weird happened, let's just return. So that's probably one of the reasons why the POSIX people wanted to allow spurious wake-ups. Okay, so questions on our while loop so far? As I said, we'll have other reasons why the general pattern is going to use this while loop, even if there are no spurious wake-ups. And to go through that, I'm going to look at sort of probably the most common pattern, maybe not the most common, but one of the most common patterns in multi-threaded code, which is this producer-consumer pattern. So let's say we have a shared buffer, so like a queue of fixed size, and we have some producer threads that add things to the queue, and some consumer threads that remove things from the queue. And if they were working sort of fast enough, we could just lock the to access the queue and unlock. But we have to worry about them not like being at the same speed. That, for example, our consumers might be faster than our producers, meaning that sometimes our consumers should wait for something to be added to the queue. Or alternatively, our producers might be faster than our consumers, and we might want to have the producers wait to not fill up our buffer. And this sort of pattern comes up all over the place. So for example, if you think of a C compiler, well, the traditional way a C compiler is structured is we have a preprocessor that produces data for a compiler, that produces data for an assembler, that produces data for a linker. And you can kind of think of this as a producer-consumer pattern where we have a bunch of stuff, preprocessor producing, compiler acting as a consumer, and acting as a producer for an assembler, which is consuming, and so on. So questions about the sort of general use case before we implement this? Okay, so let's look at, we'll start with unbounded buffer, producer-consumer. So here, the problem we have to worry about is when I'm consuming from the queue might be empty, in which case I want to wait. So to implement this, I have a lock that protects our shared data, which is this buffer, this unbounded queue. I have a condition variable, which remembers our list of waiting threads. And this is the list of threads waiting for data. Waiting for data. So waiting for there to be something on the buffer. And notice I follow our rules that our produce and consume functions, they acquire the lock before accessing the buffer or anything, do their entire operation, then release the lock. This means that if the buffer, like, we have two things to queue, it handles that case and so on. It also is going to deal with, you know, making sure I check if the buffer's empty before I dequeue. I don't need to worry about someone else dequeuing in the middle because I have a lock. In consume, I check if the buffer's empty, and if it is, I dequeue. If not, I wait, and then I recheck if the buffer is empty. And notice that because I never release the lock between this condition and this DQ here, there's no way I can actually have the DQ happen on a on an empty buffer. Like, that's not possible because nothing else is accessing the buffer in between those two things. Now we have this wait here, so the produce operation does this signal to wake up a consume thread. And you might say, what if no threads are waiting? That's fine. The signal operation will just wake up nothing if there's nothing waiting. But if there's something waiting, it will wake up any one thread. Why just one thread? Well, because we only enqueued one item. If we enqueued more than one item, well, that wouldn't be enough. But we enqueued just one, so we can know that waking up one thread is going to be all we need to do. So questions about how this code works? Okay, so we have this loop down here. While the buffer is empty, do this waiting. So can someone tell me, how can this loop run zero times? Give me a scenario where this loop would run zero times. Yeah. So the producer is faster than the consumer, so we have produce happen and then consume. Yeah. Okay, so how about having this loop run one time? What's a scenario where we run this loop one time, meaning execute one cond wait? Yeah. Okay, so we have consume runs first. Consume, it's empty, so it waits, yeah. And sleeps, yeah. And then produce runs, it runs signal, and wakes it up. Okay, so that would be a way it can run one time. And you might say, okay, so this can run our zero times, so that's a picture of our zero times, or one time, like you said, like we call consume first, then produce happens in the middle, can also run two times. And that's a little less obvious. The simplest way I know of making that happen involves three threads, which is one reason it's less obvious. And scenario looks like this. So what happens here is I have the same sort of setup as I had to have it run one time, but then something's going to happen. And that something is we have a third thread trying to consume. And so our producer signaled. And the signaled, well, it chose a thread to wake up. And it chose thread two, the only thread it could choose. And thread three came along, and it just started to consume. So it's trying to get the lock. And even though we signal thread two, the next thread to get the lock can be thread three, which it just started to consume. So thread three gets the lock next. It dequeues an item. And then thread two finally gets the lock, because it's next in line after that. Well, the only other thread to get the lock, and it finds that it's empty and starts waiting again. So it waits twice. So this is an example. There's no spurious wake up here. But we needed this while loop to deal with the situation, that some thread can start consuming after we wake up, because we aren't guaranteed to get the lock next when we're signaled. Now, you might say, gosh, you know, shouldn't we just make sure that if we stop this thread from waiting, it gets the lock next? And that is something that, yes, people have wanted to do. In fact, there's a design where we just say, you know, when we signal a thread, it runs next. And it avoids this problem. And you might say, great, so that's what POSIX implements, right? No, sorry. In fact, it's not what any threading library I'm aware of today implements. It is a well-documented design choice called hoar scheduling after the person who proposed it. But it's not what pthreads does. It's not what Java does. It's not what any threading library I'm aware of does. Instead, other threading libraries just say that any thread can get the lock next. They don't specify an order, which is called Mesa-style monitors. So after a Xerox system called Mesa. So that's what we have to deal with. So even if we don't have spurious wake-ups, we probably have that while loop. Just to deal with this sort of corner case. And the reason why is just that it makes it, it's a lot more complicated to implement that handoff operation. But with the other design, you can like kind of design your locks and condition variables independently. Whereas with the other, with if you need that handoff, you need to sort of have your locks very heavily integrated with your condition variables. Okay, so questions about design? Okay, so that's unbounded buffer. So let's talk about adding additional conditions. So bounded buffer. So with unbounded buffer, if our consumer's faster, we solve that problem. But if our producer's faster, we just make more and more memory devoted to things that are waiting to be consumed. So if we want to avoid that, we can have the producer also wait. So what I've sort of done here is I've just taken my unbounded code and I've added some checks for my producer, just see if the buffer's full, and if so, wait, which is sort of exactly the way we were waiting with the consumer case, but the condition's different. Rather than buffer.empty, it's buffer.full. And I have a separate condition variable for that. And like with the other case, I need to signal that condition variable, and I'm signaling it after I dequeue an item, so there must be space in the buffer. And I'm using signal because I know there's only one space. If I didn't know that, I need to do something else. So we could replace this with the broadcast, in which case, you know, it would just mean that there'd be more times when we wake things up. And maybe if the buffer was variable size, we'd have to do that because we don't have a good idea how much space we freed up. So you see here, that's a basic pattern, same pattern here, we're just waiting in the other direction. And, you know, I'm assuming the buffer has a fixed size and number of items, which is why I can just signal, because I know one thread can go. If I don't know that, I need to broadcast. Or if I'm not sure, I can broadcast anyways, in which case, they'll figure it out themselves, because buffer.full will tell them if they can go or not. Another thing I can do is I can, if I'm really, maybe not lazy isn't the right word, but you know, if I'm afraid of making an extra condition variable, so I only want one list of threads, I can just have one giant list of threads that are waiting for something and always broadcast to wake up all those threads and have them figure out, can I actually go now? So I could replace all these uses of data ready with just a, I could replace these all with ready, get rid of the second one, just make everything use ready and use broadcast. And this would work, it would just be inefficient. Why would it be inefficient? Because every time we enqueue something, we wake everything up that's waiting to enqueue or dequeue and have them figure out, can I do that now? Every time we dequeue something, same thing. But it would work, right? It's just slower. So these are sort of two things we can generally do, that if you're not sure if signal's enough, you can always broadcast, and well, you have that while condition, they'll figure it out. If you're not sure, if you don't separate out every possible condition into separate condition variables, you could just have one condition variable and always broadcast to it and have them figure it out with their while loop. It's just going to be slower than if you separate out to different condition variables for each possible reason to wait, so you can wake up only the right threads. So questions about our bounded producer-consumer example? Yes? So question, if we broadcast and only one can run, do all the other threads go back to sleep? So they're gonna, what's gonna happen is if we, so let's say we broadcast here, right? Let's say we broadcast here, then we'd have like three threads that would go back to this while loop. But they do so taking turns because they have to get the lock first. So the first thread would say, is the buffer empty? No, it would dequeue something. Then the second thread would acquire the lock after the first thread released it. And it would say, is the buffer empty? And it would say, yes. And it would go back to sleep. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So the general pattern for monitors, see, is that we have our operations and we have a bunch of conditions. So we acquire the lock, we check whatever condition we want to wait for. And this is extremely flexible. I've shown you sort of the producer consumer example, but if you have any sort of scenario where you say, I want to wait for something to be true, then I want to do something afterwards, the monitor pattern works for that. So the thing you want to wait for to be true, while that's not true, call cond wait. And add yourself to a list for that particular type of event. Then, when you're done waiting for something, do whatever you want to do to the shared data. And then check, did I make condition A true for anyone who was waiting for it? If so, broadcast, or if I'm sure only one thread cares, signal. And do that for every single condition that threads might be waiting for. So that's the general pattern. Sometimes you'll be able to like easily say, oh, wait, the thing I'm doing to change the shared data, that's not going to change any of the conditions. Sometimes, so we saw that like with our examples, right? Like when I consumed in our unbounded case, I knew that didn't change any condition, so I didn't have any signals or broadcasts. And also when I produced, I knew I was always changing the condition for whether a thread could consume if any were waiting, so I always signaled. So questions about this pattern? Okay, so sort of things on monitors, never touch the shared data without holding the lock. Like, don't read it or write it. That's the point of having that lock, is to make sure that you are sure about that, you know, when things use that data. You hold the lock for the entire operation. So we had this example on the quiz where sort of a wrong approach was, you know, see if there's something in an array with the array locked, then add something to the array with a separate lock. That doesn't work because, well, something can be added to the array in between those two locked parts. So lock for everything that's one operation. Like, once you unlock, you have to assume everything you checked before is no longer true. So if you found out, oh, the array is missing an element, no longer true after you unlock some of the time. Make a condition variable to have a list of threads for everything that they could wait for. And you always have a loop when you're calling con wait, and you always have to double check, did the thing I'm waiting for really happen? Both because of spurious wakeups, just the pthreads library like just randomly deciding to wait to return from con wait for no reason, and because when you're waiting, some other thread can try to start the beginning process at the same time. And when you change a condition, you need to broadcast, or if you know that only one thread cares, signal every time. You need to make sure you're looking at, for example, for this data ready case, every time you enqueue in the buffer, if you had other places you did that in the code, you need to make sure each one of them handled signaling that condition variable. You couldn't miss one. And I mentioned that there's some shortcuts you can take, which are going to slow things down, but are always correct to do if you're lazy or it's complicated to like have a separate condition variable for everything. You can use broadcast instead of when signal would work. It's not going to break anything, it's just going to be slow. You can broadcast or signal when things haven't changed. So if it's complicated to check if you change the condition, you can just broadcast and let the thread figure it out, because they're going to have the code to do that anyways. And you can use one condition variable for multiple things. You'll just have threads waking up when they don't need to. And I guess one detail I didn't mention is that, like mutexes, condition variables have an init and a destroy and this initializer value. And this is where I got in the morning earlier lecture, but let's do, since we have time, let's do this exercise. Or start this exercise at least. So let's start with, so here, rather than wait for finished, I want to wait for two things to finish. And each of them passes an index, which is either 0 or 1. So my first question is, what is the condition we want to put in that while loop? Yes, question? What? We want both of them to be true. So we don't want wait for both finished to return until both of them are true. So who would like some more time? Good. Okay, so who thinks A? B? C? D, E, okay, so we have a split between A and C, which gets to, yes, why I'm asking this, so I believe we want C. If either of them aren't true, we want to wait. So remember, this while loop is, when do we wait? It's not, when are we done? And that's a very common point of confusion. That's why I'm bringing it up. So remember, it's while is when do you want to wait is what you should be thinking. So A, like, it seems natural because we're waiting until that's true, but it's not, but the while loop is the opposite of that. So questions, comments? So that's a very common issue. I'm bringing it up because it causes lots of debugging problems. Okay, how about here? So what should we put in there? So people want more time. So talk with people, but okay. So who thinks A? B? Okay, we got some people for B. C? D? E? Okay, so we have a split between B and D, and I think D is the best answer. And B would also work. So with D, what we're doing is we're checking, did the other thread also finish? If so, then both threads must have finished so I can broadcast. With B, we're just broadcasting and saying, I'm probably the other thread finished. We'll let the thread calling wait for both finished, or threads calling wait for both finished, figure that out. So both will work. I think D is usually better. It especially looks better if we think multiple threads are calling wait for finished, because in this case we're only doing the check once and not like 10 times. As for broadcast versus signal, if if it's possible for more than one thread to call wait for both finish, we definitely need broadcast. If we somehow knew that we only allow one thread to call wait for both finish, then signal would be okay. And might be slightly more efficient. But okay, so questions about this exercise? Yes. So question, how does it know if another one is finished if it's already locked? So the way that this if condition could be true is if another thread already went all the way through the finished function. Right? Because if another thread's in the middle of it, we know the lock is held and we can't be here. Right? Because they take turns running that code. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so next time we'll look at a few more exercises with monitors, and then we'll talk a bit about counting semaphores, which are a different, very general purpose synchronization. Okay, see you Thursday.